Greetings from my living room. There is one thing that I have learned in the past 6 months from dealing with the coronavirus and everything else that's been going on, and that is flexibility. I was notified on Friday that somebody that I had been in contact with on Thursday was being tested for COVID-19, and so in discussing this with the elders, it was decided that out of an overabundance of caution, that probably it would be best if I wasn't there with you this morning in person, just to avoid the possibility of passing on the coronavirus if that other person happened to be infected and I happened to be infected because of my contact with them. Now, this led to the discussion, the decision to what many have been doing for several years, and that is putting a sermon on a video to share with you. Even though I am not there, you can watch the sermon on the screen. And this has been happening in larger churches, especially multi-site churches, for years, but also in larger churches where you can't see the preacher as closely by looking at them. They would put the image up on the screen so that you could see the screen. Well, this is just one more thing that I get to try because of coronavirus in 2020. And I have to admit, it's not quite what I have threatened to do many times when I was ill with a cold or my allergies were really acting up, when I threatened to preach using the wireless microphone from in my office. Things not being as we would expect isn't anything new. It isn't new to 2020. It isn't unique to 2020. It isn't like life had been going perfectly smooth, and then all of a sudden we've got the hiccup in the road of coronavirus in 2020. No, for as long as history has been recorded, there have been stories of the unexpected. Stories like what happens with Joseph when he's sold by his brothers into slavery in Egypt, and then he becomes the second in command of Egypt and saves his family, or David being the last one to come before Samuel when God wants him anointed the king, and he is the last one that Jesse expected would be the king. And there are many stories like that, Ruth and Naomi, all the way through the scriptures and in other places we find about that. But I go back to one of my literary favorites, the Lord of the Rings trilogy by J.R.R. Tolkien. In the final book of the trilogy, The Return of the King, Tolkien uses this in a great way. You see, the title would suggest that one should expect the king to return to his kingdom. And we all get this picture of what that will be like. He'll come riding in, leading an army of his closest followers. And when he gets there, he will be awaited by the people, and the people will be glad that he's there. But that's not what Tolkien does in his story. There is no party, there is no parade, there is nothing to signify his return to his people. But rather, the king returns leading a ghost army, and then he leads a multinational force into battle that seems to be a slaughterhouse waiting to occur, and the slaughterhouse isn't in his favor. And it isn't until another character destroys the power of the enemy that the battle is won, and then the king is recognized by his subjects, and the coronation celebration follows. The unexpected is what we will experience this morning in our text. If you have a Bible, we will turn this morning to Luke chapter 19. Luke chapter 19 is part of a transition that Luke is making up until this point in his story. Luke, well, actually, for the last third of the story of Luke, we can break it down into thirds, the beginning, the middle, and now we're getting ready to move into the final third. The last third that we have looked at some is what we would call the travel narrative. Luke moves Jesus out of his ministry in Galilee and begins moving him towards Jerusalem. And it's in a travel setting where things are based upon the movements. But as Luke is telling the story, what we come to this morning is part of the transition from the travel narratives to what would be called the passion narrative. We're going to pick up with verse 28, and I'll be reading from the English Standard Version this morning. And this is what Luke records. It says, "And when he had said these things, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. When he drew near to Bethpage and Bethany, at the mount that is called Olivet, he sent two of his disciples, saying, 'Go into the village in front of you, where on entering you will find a colt tied, on which no one has yet sat. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, why are you untying it? You shall say this, the Lord has need of it.' So those who were sent went away and found it just as he had told them. And as they were untying the colt, its owner said to them, 'Why are you untying the colt?' He said to them, or they said to them, 'The Lord has need of it.' And they brought it to Jesus, and throwing their cloaks on the colt, they set Jesus on it. And as he rode along, they spread their cloaks on the road. And as he was drawing near, already on the way down the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of his disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works they had seen, saying, 'Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest.' And some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, rebuke your disciples.' He answered, 'I tell you, if these were silent, the very stones would cry out.'" As you might be able to see, this is not how we would expect a king to enter into a capital city. They might have expected a king to enter on a powerful war horse with a legion of an army surrounding him or following in tow. Yet many seem to believe that Jesus was entering as a king. And that's what we're going to experience this morning. That's what we're going to see this morning. And to see that, it all starts with the mode of transportation. Today, if the President of the United States were going to come into our city, if the President of the United States were going to arrive somewhere, there are several ways that the President of the United States might come in. If you were going to hold a rally at the airport, he might come in, or he would come in, on Air Force One. The big plane that is called Air Force One, and it is reserved for the use of the president. And everywhere we go, everywhere the president goes, he's flying on Air Force One. And when Air Force One touches down on the tarmac, when Air Force One is parked, everybody knows that the president is present. Sometimes we also see the president coming in a different manner. When he is returning to the White House or a few other places, we see him coming in on what is known as Marine One, a helicopter that is reserved for the President of the United States of America. And when that helicopter is present, when it's coming down and touching down, you know that the president is on board. And you look and you expect to see at some point the president saluting his military protectors that are there to make sure his arrival is safe. Other times, there will be a motorcade. If the president leaves the White House to somewhere in Washington, D.C., if the president leaves an airport to go out into the community to see people, many times he will travel in a motorcade where special cars and special SUVs have been equipped that are meant to protect the president and to get him from point A to point B safely. But whatever the case, whether it's Air Force One, whether it's Marine One, whether it's a motorcade, each of them in some way lets people know that the President of the United States is present. And we understand that. We expect that's how the president will travel. Well, in Jesus' day, Jesus comes and Luke says that he came riding on the foal of a donkey, on a young donkey that had never been saddled. Nobody had ever ridden on this particular donkey. And we look at that, and many people would have looked at that in Jesus' day and said, what's the big deal? You know, some people look at that and claim, well, if Jesus had really entered on a donkey and it was such a big deal, wouldn't the Romans have said something about it? Well, the thing is they were there for the festival, and they were mainly focused on the temple. And Jesus is still outside of Jerusalem coming in, and he's riding on this donkey. And they might not have paid any attention, even if he had ridden the donkey right up to the steps of the temple, unless there was a ruckus in the temple. But to the people who were paying attention, to the people who were looking for the Messiah, for the people who had kind of been following Jesus as a good teacher and beginning to wonder if he might be the Messiah, the fact that he came riding in on a donkey, it had precedence. Because see, if you go back and you study the kings of Israel, when David is old and David is nearing the end of his life, one of his sons tries to take over the throne. Well, when news of this gets back to David, David says, put Solomon on my donkey and take him out of the city and lead him back into the city. And all the time you're leading him in, make sure that there is a procession. Make sure there is a loud noise claiming that Solomon is king. And so Jesus is riding in on this donkey as the son of David, as the descendant of David. He is riding in on a donkey and saying, through that, he's saying, as Solomon came in on a donkey, as king, I'm coming in as king. But for those who knew their Old Testament scriptures, especially those who were really into the minor prophets, that what is called the Book of the 12 in the Old Testament, we come to Zechariah chapter 9, the second to the last of the 12 prophets as far as the order in our Bibles go. And in Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9, Zechariah, on behalf of God, says this. He says, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you, righteous, and having salvation is he, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." So Jesus is looking to what it says in Zechariah, and Jesus is coming in riding on not just a donkey, but a colt, the foal of a donkey. He's riding on a young animal that hasn't been trained to be ridden, hasn't been broken for riding yet. But here comes Jesus. And Jesus, making his entry into Jerusalem, riding on the donkey, is claiming one thing, and one thing only. He is the King. Not just another king, but he is the King. He is the promised Son of David who will come and reign in righteousness. Well, if we begin to see who Jesus is based upon the mode of transportation, it's also important that we see the response of the crowd. The response of the crowd, well, if it was the President of the United States today, we would expect that if he was coming, his motorcade, there would be a parade route. And the parade route would be lined with people. And some of them would be waving their American flags and saying, acknowledging that he is the President of the United States, and acknowledging their faithfulness to the United States of America. Now, there would be others who would be standing up, and some of them would be holding placards with things written on them, and some of them would have two or three of them holding big banners up, and you would hear the crowd. Some of those banners, some of those placards would be in support of the President and whatever he was coming to town to do. Now, generally, there might be a few amidst the crowd who would be holding up placards and banners that were objecting to what the President was doing. And, well, this is 2020, so there might be more of those who want to be heard loudly objecting to whatever it is. But whatever the case, you would have this crowd lining the parade route, lining the edge of a tarmac somewhere, if he's coming in on his Air Force One. And as the President emerges, there would be loud, wild cheering. And there probably would be some loud boos. But whatever the case, that's how we would expect the crowd to respond if it was the President of the United States. The crowd in Jesus' day responds to him in the way that you would expect the crowd to respond if the King was coming into Jerusalem. Now, the crowd must not have been really large, because we see later, towards the end of the account, that it was the disciples. So it wasn't the whole city of Jerusalem. It wasn't a huge, huge entourage, necessarily. There were the 12, and probably some women, and there were probably some others amidst the crowd, and probably those who had gathered along with this company as they moved closer and closer to Jerusalem. And so the crowd of disciples was getting larger. But it says first that that the crowd, or actually the disciples, when the two disciples brought the foal of the donkey, and one of the other disciple, or one of the other gospel accounts says that both the mother and the foal were brought, and Jesus, the disciples, and when you read that, it looks like probably the 12, some of the 12, threw their garments, their outer garments on the donkey, kind of like you would a saddle blanket. Even if you were going to ride bareback on a horse, you might put a saddle blanket on it just to protect you and to protect the animal. And so they threw their coats on it to give Jesus a more comfortable ride. And then it says that the disciples put Jesus on the donkey. And I don't think that they picked him up and put him on the donkey, but they probably helped him get on the donkey. Somebody held the donkey still. Somebody helped him put his foot up there, whatever was necessary to get on the donkey. And that part makes sense. You help your leader get on the donkey. But then they go. Luke goes on and he says, they began to throw their coats down. Now, you don't just throw your coat down for anybody on the ground. You know, it takes somebody whose feet you really want to protect or whose path you really want to make special. You know, we see old-time pictures of chivalry where a guy would put his coat on over a mud puddle for a lady to walk across so she didn't get dirty. Or, sometimes you go to a wedding and they're throwing rose petals out in front of the bride as she comes down the aisle to signify a soft route going before them. Well, that's what the disciples are doing for Jesus. They're showing their respect and their honor by putting their coats down. And one of the other gospel writers says that they began to put palm branches down on the ground for him as well. And that's a way of showing dignity and respect. It's a way of saying that he is somebody important that they're preparing the way for. And then Luke says that they began to proclaim loudly that Jesus, well, he says this. He says, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest." They are really getting with it. They're claiming that Jesus is the King. Well, some of the crowd didn't like this. Some of the crowd, while we have the crowd that's laying down their coats, putting down the branches, and proclaiming that Jesus is the King, there is another part of the crowd who is rejecting Jesus and asking him to silence the crowd. Now, there are two reasons this might be. One, they're afraid that it will keep picking up in greater and greater crowds and becoming louder and louder, and he will get close enough to the temple that the Romans will hear it, and they will believe that a riot is about to take place. Or maybe a mutiny is about to take place. And they believe that the Romans will have to put that down, and these people are trying to stop that. But I think mostly it's the fact that this crowd is beginning to understand, this group of people in the crowd is beginning to understand what Jesus is claiming. And they begin to understand what the crowd is implying. And they do not recognize. They will not accept that Jesus is the King. And so they ask him to silence the crowd. It says the Pharisees asked Jesus to tell his crowd to be silent, or his disciples to be silent. And Jesus replies and says to them, "If they are quiet, the stones will cry out." If they are silent, the very stones are going to cry out. And here's the thing. twice in the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew records that the stones cry out. The first of those times is as Jesus is dying, at the end of Jesus' life on the cross. It says that as the temple veil was torn in two from the top to bottom, that there was an earthquake. The earth shook, the rocks cried out, and it even says that some of the dead, the righteous dead, were raised to life and later would be seen in Jerusalem. Then, 2 days, 3 days later, on Easter morning, Matthew records that early in the morning, that once again there was an earthquake, and the rocks cried out, and even the Roman guards saw this, saw the earthquake, heard, felt, knew about the earthquake. When the crowd was silent, the rocks will cry out. Jesus is saying to the Pharisees, Jesus is saying to his detractors, Jesus is saying that I am the King. And it doesn't matter whether you want to silence the crowd or not. God will be glorified. His name will be magnified in me. When Jesus came riding into Jerusalem on a donkey, he was making a statement. And that statement was that he was the King. And he was coming to take his rightful position as the ruler. And the crowd had to decide what they would do with this claim from Jesus. Unfortunately, as the gospel writers record it for us, as Luke says for us here in our passage this morning, there were really two misunderstandings. The crowd wanted him to be the king who would free them from Roman occupation. And two, the Pharisees, who did not believe that he was the king, wanted him silenced and wanted the crowd silenced. Today, we have to make the same decision. What will we do with this claim that Jesus is the King? Will we try to make him something other than what he claimed to be? Will we look at him and say that he was a good teacher, that he was a moral man whose life we should follow? Or will we, like the Pharisees, reject him because we don't like who he is and what he claims on our lives? Or finally, we have the opportunity to make the choice to see him as the King of the universe, who came not to free us from oppression physically, but to free us from the oppression of our sins, and to follow him as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Following him will mean that we give up our own desires, and we live in line with his rule. Following him also means that we will celebrate with him when he returns as the conquering king and judge of all people.